This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
So if you're agnostic, like if you don't care where your electricity comes from, right? Like you don't care about the environment. The only thing you want is I need electricity, I need it fast, and I need it cheap. The answer to all three of those very often ends up being renewables.
As the summer sizzle approaches, it's time to talk about the paradox of air conditioning. How keeping ourselves cooler functions to make the planet hotter. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with Umair Irfan, a climate reporter from Vox.com, to discuss air conditioning and the promise of renewable energy. We look at how some of the planet's hottest cities are trying to survive in the face of consistent, record-breaking high temperatures, and talk about how breakthroughs in the battery storage sector provide some hope that the renewable energy market will continue to grow. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Umair Irfan. He is a climate reporter and correspondent for Vox.com. Umair, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thanks for having me.
As we're heading into the hot season, we can look back at some of the work that you've done in the past on this air conditioning paradox. We just had record temperatures for May in Texas. They're having heat waves in India and Pakistan. You write that the tactics for cooling can end up worsening the very problem they're trying to solve if they draw on fossil fuels or leak refrigerants that are potent heat-trapping gases. And the people who stand to experience the most extreme heat are often those least able to cool off. So how do we move forward with this problem of trying to keep people cool while the actual air conditioning heats up the planet?
Right. Yeah, it means that we have to really be careful and thoughtful about how we pursue this. Heat is often, you know, underrated as a health threat. We often think of heating in the winter as a necessity, but we think of air conditioning often as a luxury in many parts of the world, and we treat it as not quite as essential or as something that's a nice to have. But really, when we're getting to these extreme temperatures in many parts of the world earlier and earlier in the year, we're finding that heat is deadly. Like, you absolutely need some way to cool off. Like, it is a life-saving measure to have some form of cooling, whether that's fans or air conditioning. So this is not simply a luxury anymore. And as we have more people packed into these dense cities that are also getting hotter because of the urban heat island effect and because of the warming of the planet as a whole, there are more people that are vulnerable. And so one of the most effective tactics is to cool the environment that you're in, and that's using air conditioning, particularly indoors. The problem is using air conditioning to actively cool your space draws on energy, that increases energy demand, and if you're not getting energy from a clean source or if you're drawing on the existing dirty fossil fuel infrastructure, you're increasing the amount of the heat-trapping gases that are kind of worsening the problem to begin with. And if the technology that you're using for air conditioning, if the air conditioners you use are not great quality, they can leak refrigerant gases that can also heat up the planet. The chemicals that you use to power air conditioners, those are actually many times more powerful than carbon dioxide when it comes to trapping heat in the atmosphere. So small leaks in refrigerants can have big effects in terms of warming.
So we eliminated a lot of the chemicals that were coming from refrigerants in the Montreal Protocol a few decades ago, but the problems didn't just disappear. Yes, we don't have acid rain issues like we did back in the 80s, but what are some of the biggest hurdles that we need to overcome to be able to roll out air conditioning on a mass scale without it doing significant harm in terms of releasing greenhouse gases and heating up the planet further?
Right. You get at a good point that we do have solutions for this. Like, this is not a completely intractable problem. It's just that the tools are often very expensive and not always available to everybody. So air conditioners are not cheap devices. They're they can cost a lot of money, and particularly in a developing country, that can be a pretty significant share of your income. And to run an air conditioner also costs a lot of money. And you're using electricity often during the most congested times of day on the power grid. So if you're in an area that has dynamic pricing, you want to run your air conditioner at the time of day when it's actually the most expensive time to do so. And so it becomes very costly, even if you have an air conditioner, just to run it. And oftentimes people are trying to make decisions about how to be judicious and how they use that. There are ways around some of these problems. So things like the refrigerant gases, there are alternative chemicals that you can use that don't heat up the planet as much. Like, we have alternative refrigerants that actually don't have that same problem with warming, and also don't deplete the ozone layer, which was part of the reason we signed the main reason we signed the Montreal Protocol to begin with. And so we have those chemicals. It's just that it requires, you know, a new generation of technology. So that would require replacing a lot of the existing air conditioning infrastructure with these newer air conditioners that don't have these heat trapping chemicals that are also more energy efficient. And so simply switching from this old clunky technology that may be worse for the environment to the new one, there's a big opportunity cost to that. There's a big financial cost to that. And then simply to run these air conditioners on the scales that are needed to cool the people that absolutely need it, that's also going to increase our net energy footprint, because according to the laws of physics, you know, you have to actually do work in order to cool an area, particularly when everything else around it is hot. And so to do that heat exchange, you need an energy input. There's a physical minimum that you need in terms of how much energy, and there's really just no way around it. And so the questions we need to start thinking about is, how do we make air conditioning more affordable? How do we reduce its environmental footprint? How do we increase access to cooling? And how do we do it in a way that maximizes the amount of benefit that we can get, that we try to get cooling to the people that need it the most? Oftentimes, these are people who have to, you know, work outdoors, agricultural workers, construction workers, taxi drivers, people who by necessity have to be outside. And so the cooling that they have access to is very scarce. So we need to come up with ways, not just with air conditioning, but also with ways that we cool our cities, cool our neighborhoods, and try to create a whole environment that also facilitates lowering temperatures overall.
And it's not just in the middle of the day where these high temperatures are causing so much problems. It's also that we're seeing record highs at night. When it doesn't get below 90, 95 degrees in the middle of the night, it's a horrible reality for billions of people.
That's right. You know, heat has a cumulative effect. And so while, you know, it stays in triple digit temperatures during the day, if it stays warm at night, your body doesn't get much relief. And increasingly, we're seeing that trend build up, particularly in urban areas, when you have things like roads, like concrete, asphalt, steel. These materials, they absorb heat during the day and they hang on to it for the evening. And so that means that if you're particularly working in an urban area, those temperatures don't drop off significantly the way they would in a more rural area or in an area that has more vegetation. The net effect then is that people have more exposure to heat, and that leads to more of the health complications that we tend to associate with extreme heat. So things like heart attacks, high blood pressure, emphysema, breathing problems. One of the biggest, the strongest indicators of heat-related illness is high nighttime temperatures. And yeah, that's becoming one of the hallmarks of a modern heat wave, that we're seeing nighttime temperatures stay very high. And that ends up being a much bigger health burden than simply really hot temperatures during the day. I was like, good gracious, asshole spacious, flirtatious, trying to show faces. I'm waiting for the right time to shoot my steam, you know, waiting for the right time to flash them keys. And I'm leaving, please believe in me and the rest of my heathens. Checking out a lock at the top of the Four Seasons. Penthouse, rooftop, birds, I'm feeding. No deceiving, nothing up my sleeve, no teasing. I need you to get up on the dance floor. Get that man what he
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Umair Irfan. He is a climate reporter for Vox. So, Umair, we're talking about air conditioning and extreme temperatures. Maybe you can contrast the approach to extreme temperatures in like a Dubai versus a Phoenix. Where are the similarities and where are the differences?
Yeah, one of the big factors you have to think about with heat is sort of the familiarity that the environment has with heat. Do they have a culture of understanding the risks of heat and taking precautions accordingly? So in the Middle East, you know, this is an area that is naturally very hot, and there is, you know, a lot of infrastructure that supports people being indoors and sheltered. Where people mainly drive places, they're not walking a whole lot, so they're in air-conditioned cars and buses as they get around. And in many of these hotter regions in the Middle East, you know, they tend to be fairly wealthy countries that have a lot of the wealth to basically distribute the electricity and have the air conditioning available. Phoenix also has like a lot of experience with extreme heat, and so they have actually a fairly robust citywide health plan for how to cope with heat. They have alerts that go out early in the season. Most people who live in Phoenix understand that you have to stay hydrated during the day to be proactive, like not to wait until you start seeing heat symptoms, but to rather get out of the heat before you start feeling woozy and to seek shade and to take breaks. But where you start seeing some of the most severe effects of heat are in places that actually don't have a very hot baseline. You may remember that there was a big heat wave in the Pacific Northwest a few years ago that went through, you know, Washington State, Oregon, and British Columbia and Canada. That turned out to be an exceptionally deadly heat wave because this is a region that is not used to extreme heat. The heat temperatures did not get as hot as they did in Phoenix. You know, we weren't necessarily talking about 120 degree days of heat, but this is a region where very few people actually have air conditioning at home. So when temperatures did get into the 80s and 90s, people didn't have easy places that they could find relief. They didn't necessarily recognize the symptoms of heat stress and to get help when they needed it. And employers didn't realize that, you know, they have to be proactive about giving their employees breaks, about things like, you know, making sure that kitchens and restaurants are much cooler than they need to be otherwise, and that they take, you know, some of these other steps that you have to do in order to mitigate the effects of heat. And so without that culture, without that infrastructure, and without that sort of baseline experience, heat ends up being more deadly. And so while we focus on some of the high temperatures that we're seeing in places like the Middle East when it gets to 120 and 130 degrees Fahrenheit, you know, even 80 and 90 degree heat waves can be dangerous if they're happening in areas that aren't used to them. And we're also seeing that happen as well. Like in some places, like they've developed a culture where it should be 65 degrees in the summer indoors all summer long. And that ends up using a lot more energy than you would need otherwise if you were to, you know, allow temperatures to rise a little bit more and maybe be okay with sweating a little bit. And so there's that aspect of it to think about as well.
You go to a mall in Phoenix, it's going to be 65 degrees versus going to a mall in Dubai, it could be 80s. Mm-hmm. But people learn to, as you said, there's a longer history of adapting to these extreme temperatures in the Middle East.
Yeah. And, you know, some countries have tried to make some of these cultural changes. You know, Japan is actually kind of an interesting case study. After the Fukushima Daiichi disaster in 2011, there was a big energy crunch. And so one thing they did was the national government basically tried to change the workplace culture so that people didn't have to wear suits to the office in the summer, that they weren't wearing these two-piece and three-piece wool suits. They could go to work in Hawaiian shirts and allow the temperatures in their office to actually go up a little bit, to run the fans, open the windows, rather than cranking up the air conditioning, so that people would be a little bit more casual, more comfortable with higher temperatures, and not worry so much about sweating and being a little less formal as a way to save energy. It did change the culture a little bit. There's like this whole, I think they called it cool biz. And basically that there was sort of like this little culture of fashion about people coming up with workwear that is also heat tolerant and some interesting designs. But there are also limitations to that because, you know, there are some cultural norms that you want to maintain. You know, there's a lot of formality, especially in the business world and in government. And it's a bigger challenge to try to change people's expectations of what they should be putting up with. Like, certainly we don't want to put people in danger with extreme heat, but do we really need it to have temperatures cold enough that you wear a sweater indoors in the middle of summer, like that might be the too much in the other direction of an extreme. And so getting people's expectations right in terms of what to expect, in terms of how comfortable or where that level of comfort should be, is an important part of the equation, but it's also one of the harder things to change.
And from just a equity and human rights issue, in some of these areas of the world where there's extreme heat, we tend to see the haves and the have-nots. Cooling and air conditioning and just being able to live in a comfortable temperature may be one of the new work benefits of the future in some of these cultures that have a lot more inequity, like in the Middle East, where I know in Qatar, for example, when they were building the stadiums for the World Cup, there was terrible human rights abuses we read about with slave labor and bringing people in from other countries and taking their passports. These people were probably working in very inhospitable temperatures, I can imagine.
Yeah, and you know, the sort of cultural expectations around tolerating heat are also an interesting thing to explore. Like in the US, for instance, there in many parts of the country, there's no requirement for prisons to be air conditioned, including in some of the hottest states. And so these are basically facilities that turn into ovens because they're mainly like concrete and steel, and there's almost no air flow within them, and lots of people are put in danger. And it's very hard to get the public support to protect prisoners from extreme heat because there's this idea that, you know, prison is supposed to be bad and that it's supposed to be uncomfortable and that you should suck it up. And similarly, like in outdoor professions like construction, there's this sort of like machismo and cultural like pushing to try to like endure more and more heat. What's actually kind of interesting is that in the military, they've actually been fairly progressive and proactive about dealing with extreme heat because they've developed some of the more stringent regulations around exposure to extreme heat. In fact, in the United States, in the 1950s, there were a number of deaths on Army training bases, and they developed a new metric called the wet bulb globe temperature that takes into account heat, humidity, and sunlight exposure. And they developed strict guidelines for when, you know, soldiers and trainees are allowed to be outdoors and when to limit their exposure. And the military has been doing this since the 1950s, but farm workers and, you know, prisoners and even like high school athletes are forced to often pushed to continue to work outdoors or in hot conditions well past temperatures and thresholds that would be considered dangerous for the military. And so there's not this uniform sort of expectation of what is considered to be dangerous. And that means that there's a lot more people that are vulnerable than need to be.
Yes, you mentioned humidity. Isn't that kind of the basic idea of air conditioning originally? There were already ways to cool with ice and fans and things like that. But the real breakthrough of air conditioning was that it was able to lower those humid conditions, right?
Yeah, I mean, one of the main use cases for air conditioning when it was first invented was to reduce humidities in libraries to preserve books. Like the concern was that moisture in the air was warping books and causing them to rot, and to protect wood in indoor buildings. And so there's a lot of not just effects on humans, but also on our infrastructure. When we have this combination of heat and humidity, it leads to things like, you know, rotting in wood and, you know, framing in houses, but it can also lead to things like mold growth and other kinds of like indoor problems that we associate that can also have other important health effects as well as effects on our infrastructure. So there's a lot of knock-on effects of trying to keep things within an optimal temperature range, both in terms of heat, humidity, and also sunlight exposure.
Yeah.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Umair Irfan. He's a climate reporter for Vox. You and your colleagues wrote a piece last month talking about how adapting to things like extreme heat is actually good business. Why don't you expand?
Right. So when you're facing these problems, obviously there's the human cost, but there's also an economic cost. When we're talking about things like exposure to extreme heat, people are less productive. People get injured more, and that adds up to cost to businesses. And generally, it has huge knock-on effects to the environment. Like, you know, when we're talking about broader changes to the climate, things like sea level rise, for instance, it's putting coastal properties at risk, and that's making it harder to insure those properties. It's making it more expensive when disasters do strike. So there's all this economic cost that ends up rippling and magnifying throughout the economy. And increasingly, a lot of businesses are finding that actually it's prudent to start investing in things that reduce greenhouse gas emissions, both over the long term, but increasingly in the near term as well. It turns out, for instance, that about 80 to 90% of new electricity that was added to the power grid worldwide in the past year was renewable. And it wasn't because there's a big global climate policy, there was no international carbon tax. It's just that wind and solar are often the cheapest and fastest ways to add electricity to the power grid. If you need electrons right now, you're probably going to be able to buy a solar panel. Like, you can go to a hardware store and buy solar panels and inverters and start installing them the same day. Building a new power plant, a big coal plant or a gas plant, takes months, if not years, to permit and then build and install, and it costs a lot more money. And so for a lot of folks, they're finding that this is the thing that actually gives them the most versatility and at the lowest cost. And so there's the business case there. So if you're agnostic, like if you don't care where your electricity comes from, right? Like, you don't care about the environment. The only thing you want is, I need electricity, I need it fast, and I need it cheap. The answer to all three of those very often ends up being renewables. And in fact, in many parts of the world, renewables, building new renewable energy is actually cheaper than running existing fossil fuel plants. And so we're actually seeing in some markets where coal is expensive, it's actually cheaper to shut down a coal plant ahead of schedule to retire it early and replace it with renewables than it would be to continue running that existing plant. And it's not just that renewables are cheap, they also kind of provide a hedge against volatility in fuel markets.
So we know that renewables are comparing favorably to fossil fuels when we're talking about electric grids, but what about fuels in general? We're looking at a real transition in our transportation fleet right now, for example. Maybe you can give us some more examples of how it makes just good business sense to not be burning fossil fuels as much as we have been.
Well, in the United States, you know, we don't have a national oil company. We don't have a national gas company. So the price of oil and gas is set by the market. And the U.S. is not the only market. So even if the U.S. drills a lot more oil and gas, that doesn't necessarily lower gas prices. Like, we're still vulnerable to price shocks in other parts of the world. Right now, we have sort of a trade war going on. If it gets a lot more expensive for U.S. oil and gas customers to buy our product, that can lead to a sudden price drop here in the U.S. Or if there's another conflagration in another part of the world, that can lead to a global price spike, even if the U.S. is producing most of its fuel domestically, because, again, we don't have a nationalized price system. And if you're a factory, if you're running a big data center, all that volatility kind of scares you because you have to build your business case for the next 10, 20, 30 years. And increasingly, what they're finding is that rather than making their energy so vulnerable to these international markets, it makes more sense to onshore, to sort of like take ownership of their energy with renewables. Sunlight and wind are pretty much free. You don't pay for the fuel, you pay for the generator. And we're finding that, you know, a lot of businesses that need energy, like things like data centers, these tech companies are actually some of the largest purchasers of renewable energy. They're installing and procuring a lot more renewable energy in part because it insulates them from price shocks, and that gives them a guaranteed rate. Even if they're paying a little bit more now, they know that they can count on that electricity price to stay fairly stable for decades to come, and it helps them build a business case for that.
And bolstering the renewable case are the breakthroughs that we're seeing in the battery industry. You shared a chart from the International Renewable Energy Agency in Vox. It says, in just 5 years, utility scale battery capacity has accelerated by 29 times. And it's a pretty impressive hockey stick graph there. But this is not even including a lot of the promising technologies that we keep getting teased about, that there's something around the corner that's going to be just light years ahead of what we have right now in terms of batteries. So that seems to be one of the more promising sectors within the clean energy innovative space. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, because, as you know, energy storage enables a lot of things. It's not just renewables. Like, you know, yes, the sun will set and sometimes the wind will stop blowing and you need a way to compensate for that. But when you can store electricity on the power grid, it allows you to do arbitrage. Like you can, when electricity is cheap, you can store it and then you can sell it back on the power grid when it's expensive. So that's a new line of business for a utility. Utilities like that. You can store energy for backup during emergencies. You can use batteries to help, you know, bolster some of the older parts of the power grid and save you money that you would otherwise have to spend on upgrades. And so there's a lot of functions that help, smooth things over with batteries. It's not just for renewables. And increasingly, even fossil fuel generators like using batteries as well, because think about like a hybrid car, for instance, right? A gasoline engine prefers to run at a steady state, and you can use the battery to help you give you a boost when you're accelerating and absorb when you're braking. Similarly, you can do that on the power grid. You know, you can run maybe a coal generator or a gas generator flat out at a steady rate, and instead of ramping up and down, it uses a battery to compensate for the variations that they see in demand. And that means that the power plant runs more efficiently, and that lowers their costs. And also, it just makes the grid more efficient overall and can actually help lower emissions from fossil fuel infrastructure as well. So it has all these halo effects that we're just starting to see. And we're still in the early stages of this. That basically, like 5 years ago, around 2020, like the U.S. did not have very much battery energy storage on the grid at all. And as you noted, like many orders of magnitude, it has grown in just the past few years. And there's no signs of it slowing down because we're still in the early stages of it.
So here we are at a crossroads in our democracy with the world's largest economy and military being led by an unhinged, mendacious maniac and an administration that openly defies climate science. But there's still reasons to be hopeful.
Yeah, even though like we're in a very volatile moment right now, there's a lot of momentum behind clean energy, that it's not just the environmental merits, it's the business merits are very robust. And while we could go up or down on the margins, the overall trend is still one that favors more clean energy in the years to come.
Umair Irfan from Vox, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me. Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Five Alarm Funk, Nelly, and Major Lance.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.